What do you got for us tonight, Joe?
Well, tonight we are going to cover a case that has been on my bucket list for literally years. On the morning of Sunday, July 26th, 2009, a 36-year-old woman named Diane Schuler packed five children into a minivan and left the campground in New York State where they'd spent the weekend to make the trip home. What followed was a bizarre string of events. For reasons unknown, Diane deviated from the route home and wound up driving 85 miles per hour into opposite lanes of traffic. She soon collided head-on with another vehicle, killing herself, four of the five children, and all three men in the other vehicle. She has since become known as the Taconic Parkway Killer, and her case has spawned hundreds of articles, books, documentaries, and, of course, podcasts. So tonight, we here at Dawn of Mantis are going to take our own look at Diane's case and try to make some sense out of it.
Quiet your mind. Ever since the Earth has circled the sun, there have been fantastic tales of wonder and mystery that the fate of Hart dare not discuss. But three brave, uninformed souls have the brass to tackle every extraordinary happenstance from the modern age to the dawn of Mantis.
Welcome to Dawn of Mantis, true crime, mysteries, and more. I'm Ivan with Joe and Sam here in the beautiful Redbeard Sound Studio.
It is beautiful.
You guys doing okay tonight?
Doing good.
Doing great, man.
So, hey, it's a new year. We have a new segment that we're going to do every once in a while. I don't know if we're going to do it weekly. I plan on doing it weekly, but if we lose interest, it'll just go away and everyone will wonder where it went. But I decided to call it Twitch.
Okay.
This week in true crime history, because I don't think Twitch has already taken, I mean, I've heard like a muscle Twitch, but I don't think it's copyrighted by anyone. Do you guys?
Sure. No, we'll just say that it's not.
Nah.
Anyway. So, hey, let's get on with it.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen and true crime aficionados, it's time for This Week in True Crime History. It's where we look back at any malice and mayhem that happened this week in history.
All right, so sometimes we're going to cover things we've covered before to kind of throw back to our old episodes. Joe, you're going to love this one, and I hope you have a lot of the information off the top of your head.
Oh, God. Okay.
January 10th, 2 years ago, Robert Durst, convicted murderer, died.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. He was the main suspect, and that I didn't look up the episode number, but it's way back there.
It was within the first 10 episodes, he was convicted of killing Kathy Durst.
Yeah. My fault. But anyway, suspected the disappearance of his first wife.
Yeah.
And then 2000 murder of his longtime friend, Susan Berman.
Yes.
2001 killing of his neighbor, Morris Black. So, and then I have another one. I'm so curious if you've heard of this case. Shanda Renee Scherer.
Shanda Scherer?
Yeah.
That does not ring a bell. No.
She died on January 11th, 1992. American girl who was tortured and burned to death in Madison, Indiana. But this is the unique thing. By four teenage girls. She was 12 at the time.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, the perpetrators were between 15 and 17 years old. So I would imagine that might be one we cover in the future.
They tortured and burned her?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, Shanda Scherer.
Yeah.
Okay, let's remember that because we will definitely. What did I say before this?
Yeah, that we'd pick up episodes from it,
yes.
Which is really good. So we'll have one that's kind of timely so you can kind of listen in and say, hey, that happened this week a long time ago or maybe not that long ago. So that's two of them for you this week.
I love it. Thank you, man.
No problem.
This was a
no
great,
problem.
By the way, this was all Ivan's brainchild. And man, I'm excited to hear this every week now. This is great.
I was just kind of thinking something that, you know, stayed with the time. Since we are a weekly podcast, we might as well put out some weekly content that goes with the date that it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's This Week in True Crime History.
What was the guy's name?
Robert Durst was the
Robert
guy.
Robert Durst.
Yeah.
The Jinx.
Yes.
The Jinx.
Was that HBO that did that documentary?
They did.
It was
they
like
did.
A several part documentary. Mm-hmm. Really great. Yeah.
You listen to our episode first and then watch the HBO. Do it in that order.
Yes.
You remember what that episode was called?
Oh, no, I don't, man.
I can't find it.
It was really... Was that Where on Earth Is? Was that...
It could have been. It could have been pre-Dawn of Mantis.
It was pre-Dawn of Mantis. It doesn't even exist, guys.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. I mean, it may exist on some hard drive of Ivan's somewhere.
I plugged us, but we really didn't do it. But we did.
We did cover it.
In our original 12-episode run of Where on Earth Is.
Maybe we should, like, revive those old episodes.
I think I have them. I think I have them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, as everyone... I mean, anyone who has... been following us knows before we, you know, hatched Dawn of Mantis, Ivan and I, we started this other podcast like 6-7 years ago called Where on Earth Is, and we only did 12 episodes of it before we kind of abandoned that and we started this. So anyway, yeah, we might dig back in the vault and grab those Robert Durst episodes and repost them or something.
Yeah. All right. Let's get on with this one.
So yeah, Diane Schuler, the Taconic Parkway Killer. Now, speaking of HBO, now... listen to the rest of this episode, people, please. But also, as a companion to this, or maybe we would be the companion to the documentary. And I believe it was HBO did a fantastic documentary about this, and it's called There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane. Hmm. You don't have to go to HBO. It's on YouTube. Just type in There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, and that's going to be the first thing that comes up. I do want to warn you that towards the end of the documentary, they show unfiltered the bodies, or at least Diane's, after post crash, and my God, is it graphic?
I probably won't watch then. As I'm getting older, I just that, and I've talked about it on here before. I can't go there.
Yeah,
it's like I want to see sunshine and rainbows, but then I come in every week and sit here and here for this podcast. But I guess I'm not seeing it. I can actually not visualize if True. I choose not to.
I'm telling you, though, this is one of those documentaries. I watch it probably once a year.
Wow.
And I have for several years. It will stick with you. And so just a few months ago, I got into it again, kind of when I did this part of this research. And I told my wife, it was one night when our six-year-old was with her grandma. I was like, can we sit down for like 2 hours and watch this documentary? And she said the same thing. It sticks with you. It is so bizarre. It's such a weird case.
Yeah.
So tragic. So ready to get...
I definitely am.
Diane was born in 1973, and she was the fourth child of five and the only daughter of Warren and Eileen Hance. Now, the family lived in Floral Park, New York, and by all accounts, Diane had a fairly typical childhood early on. But that all changed in 1982 when her mother, Eileen, abandoned the family. Diane was just 9, but from what her friends and family said, she stepped up and assumed a motherly role over her brothers, even though 3 were older than her. Throughout her adolescence and into adulthood, Diane never showed any signs of depression or mental illness, at least that we know of. Many of the people she went to school with have been interviewed and all say that she was a good kid. Despite the pressures of having to balance school with helping run the household in her mother's absence, Diane was reportedly jovial, optimistic, and was widely known as the class clown at her school. The only real indication of any psychological damage her mother may have caused her was Diane's absolute refusal to speak about her mother to anyone. And this was from childhood on to adulthood.
Okay.
It was she just blacked that part out.
Okay.
All she'd say was that she left the family, the mother, and that was it. But maybe that was just her way of dealing with it. Who knows? Later on, Eileen, the mother, reached out to her children and reportedly reconciled with all of the brothers, but Diane refused to ever have anything to do with her.
Hmm.
So yeah. that was a burnt bridge that she couldn't mend.
One could only guess.
Right.
I would imagine it's quite bad.
Yeah. Around 1995, Diane attended a friend's wedding, and this is where she met her future husband, Daniel Schuler. The pair hit it off instantly, and after a brief engagement, they were married. Friends of Diane's would later say that throughout high school, she had never really dated anyone, so her marriage to Daniel was also essentially her first real relationship. This could be due to a number of factors. As we said before, in her mother's absence, Diane was the woman of the house, and maybe she just hadn't had the time to date during high school. Another factor could possibly be her weight. Throughout much of her childhood, Diane's weight would fluctuate, usually staying on the heavier side. Those who knew her believe this affected her confidence and was a main contributor to her remaining single during her teenage years. However, by 1995, She had lost a considerable amount of weight and showed up to her friend's wedding looking the best she'd ever had. This very likely also had her confidence at an all-time high, so it really shouldn't be a shock that she and Daniel hit it off so well when they first met. And also, I don't know. Okay, yeah, Sam does have it pulled up. Anyone listening, when you have the time, you can run to Google, look up Diane Schuler, and there are pictures actually from that wedding where she met Daniel. I got to say, I mean, we're not going to like her later.
I mean, she looks likable enough there, like a just a normal person.
And a really pretty lady.
Yeah, oh yeah,
just totally. I mean, anybody would see that and say, sure. Oh, wow, that's a pretty lady.
Yeah, really.
Well, after about 8 years together, Diane had her first child, a son named Brian. 3 years later, Diane and Daniel had a baby girl they named Erin. According to everyone who knew her, Diane embraced her role as a mother and was very good at it. In fact, several acquaintances called her Supermom. She volunteered to chaperone field trips, helped with school activities, hosted play dates, and baked cookies for fundraisers. When little Brian started school, he was always the first one to be dropped off. He and baby Erin were always impeccably dressed, not a hair out of place, not so much as a scuff on their shoes. All this despite the fact that Diane worked full-time as a director of credit, billing, and collections at Cablevision. And this was a job that earned her over $100,000 a year.
Wow.
She made damn good money.
Yeah, that is good.
Daniel, who, let's be honest, I'll just spoiler alert, we won't like him either at the end.
Okay.
You may like or not like Diane at the end. And that's the whole point of this, man. When we're done with the facts of this, I really want to talk to you guys about what you think, you know, about the ins and outs of why she did what she did.
Okay.
So Daniel, he also had a job. He worked as a security guard for the Parks Department, but he only earned a fraction of what Diane did. So along with being a super mom, she was also the main breadwinner. Daniel's own mom described him more as the oldest kid rather than the husband. So it certainly sounds like Diane had a lot on her plate. She and Daniel's schedules were opposite. So as she was arriving home from work, he was leaving and vice versa. So she would get up early, get the kids ready, make lunches, make food for Daniel, then take Erin to daycare, drop Brian off at school, and head to work. Then after work, she'd pick up the kids, head home, make dinner, bathe the kids after eating, tuck them in, read them a book, and after they were asleep, she would do the laundry, dishes, cleaning, and other housework that needed to be done before finally going to bed herself and repeating the entire thing again the next day.
Wow.
That sounds like a lot. It was a lot. I also understand that a lot of people do that. It wasn't just her.
Yeah. It goes without saying, like, someone could make your own lunch, you know, like the husband.
Yeah.
That's a very small part, or not even a part, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
A very obvious comment. But I understand there are a lot of wives that do that for husbands, and that's cool. That's fine.
Yeah.
But if you've got a wife that's like the breadwinner and has so much on her plate, the husband could.
You could make your lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's just a little thing, but you know what? It's a big thing.
I never understood that thing where like some husbands will get all butt hurt or like they feel like it affects their masculinity if their wife makes more money than them. I would be happy. I would be the happiest guy on earth if my wife came home and was like, oh, I got this raise and now I make 20 grand more than you a year. I would have no problem with that.
Mine does. I mean, she's been in the profession longer, so she's going to make more.
Right.
She's higher on the pay scale. So. And I don't care.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, well, no, I should make more all the time. Yeah. I have not a penis.
That I don't care. I'm saying what you're saying. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Good for you. You go. You go, girl. Hey, can I buy this thing?
Can I have my allowance now, sweetheart?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I know millions of parents do this every day, like I just said, but I'm not trying to make Diane sound like a saint or hero or anything. I'm just painting a picture of what her life was like, according to her husband, family, friends, and coworkers, leading up to the tragic events that ended her and seven other people's lives. I'm trying to say that according to everyone who knew her, Diane Schuler was a great mom, a rock solid, dependable, compassionate human being, which makes the events of July 26th, 2009, all the more bizarre. Right. So up until that day, according to everyone, I mean, and like I said, watch this documentary. There is no one who said that she exhibited any signs of anything that would make you think she would do anything. Like, she was always like the one you could depend on, right?
Yeah.
Diane was the one that was rock solid and you never had to worry about her. So anyway, just trying to paint that picture.
So we're in for a surprise later, I guess.
Oh my God. It is one, like I said, it's one of the most bizarre and strangest things we'll ever cover on this podcast. Ever.
Yeah.
It's mind boggling. So the weekend of July 26th, the Schulers planned a camping trip. So along with Diane, Daniel, Brian, and Aaron were Diane's three nieces. And that was 9-year-old Emma, 7-year-old Allison, and 5-year-old Katie. The girls were the daughters of Diane's brother, Warren Hance. It sounds like camping was a regular activity for the Schulers, although I don't know how common it was for the nieces to go along. It appears that they either kept an RV at the campgrounds or rented one there, because in later interviews, Daniel described previous trips to Hunter Lake and staying in a camper there, but they never pulled it to or from the campsite.
Okay.
Right. So I don't know if they, I know you can rent RVs where they are.
Yeah. Yeah. You can do that now. I didn't know they had that back then, but they could have.
Yeah.
I'm sure they had.
I don't know which was which.
Yeah.
Regardless, Diane was now transporting 5 kids. So she borrowed her brother's minivan to take to the campgrounds. And that was a 2003 Ford Windstar minivan. Daniel and the family dog traveled up there separately in his truck, pulling their boat, and had left a little earlier so that he could have everything set up, right, when everyone else got there.
Okay.
The weekend apparently went great. Everyone swam, fished, rode the boat around the lake. There are several pictures from the trip that you can easily find. I think Sam might be Googling them now. They show the kids were happy and having a great time. According to Daniel, Diane displayed zero signs of any odd behavior that weekend, but then came Sunday morning, July 26th. Out of the 7 people who attended the camping trip that weekend, only 2 would survive, Daniel and little Brian. So for an account of that morning's events, we have to rely solely on Daniel. According to him, he got up around 6 o'clock that morning and set about getting the boat ready to leave and picking up around the campsite. He says he woke Diane up around 6:45 to 7, and together they packed up all their things and loaded up the van and the truck. After that, they had a cup of coffee together. At around 9 a.m., Ann Scott, owner of Hunter Lake Campgrounds, stopped by and spoke with Diane and Daniel for a few minutes. She knew the Schulers from their previous trips and would later say that Diane seemed completely normal and, more importantly, sober. That's going to come into play later. At approximately 9:30 a.m., the family left the campsite in their respective vehicles, Daniel with the family dog in the truck, and Diane with their 2 children and their 3 nieces in the minivan. The plan was for Daniel to head on home and go to sleep because he had to go to work later that night, while Diane took the kids to McDonald's for breakfast, dropped off her nieces, and then headed on home. That is most definitely not how the day's events would play out. First off, everyone who tells this story says that Diane didn't start exhibiting any strange behavior until later in the trip, but I disagree. I think the strangeness was evident right from the outset. And my reasoning is that Diane didn't reach the McDonald's in Liberty until 9:56 a.m. The Hunter Lake campground is only 9 miles from there. That's a 15-minute drive at most. Yet it took Diane almost twice that time to get there. So already I think that's weird. It took her almost half an hour.
Yeah.
To cover a trip that should have taken like 14 to 15 minutes. So already it's weird.
I mean, she didn't do anything else.
No. And I'm telling you, from here on out, it's going to get weird as shit. Nothing that she did after she left that campground makes any damn sense whatsoever.
Hmm.
There may be some plausible explanation for this, but it just seems weird to me. You know, the time that it took her to get there. Anyways, the kids ate breakfast and afterwards played in the play area at McDonald's while Diane watched. As far as I know, CCTV footage of this does exist, but has not been made public. Diane then reportedly ordered an orange juice, and she and the kids left McDonald's at approximately 10:33, so that means they spent about 37 minutes there. And let's remember, keep under your hat that she ordered a large orange juice.
Okay.
As weird as that sounds, as insignificant as it sounds, that's going to come into play later, too. From there, Diane drove to a Sunoco gas station, and the CCTV footage does show her pulling up to a gas pump. You can look this up. Everything I'm describing can be easily found on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah, all the CCTV footage of this. It shows her pulling up to the gas pump. She gets out, walks into the store, and then after like seconds in the store, she goes right back out to the van. So audio doesn't exist, but the cashier later said that she asked for a specific kind of pain reliever, and when they said they didn't have it, Diane turned around and left.
Hmm.
Okay? So for some reason, she's in search of Tylenol, Advil. I don't know what she was looking for, but something is hurting her, I guess. Headache, I don't know. But there's also something strange here that, as far as I know, nobody else has pointed out. Diane left McDonald's at 10:33 and arrived at the Sunoco gas station at 10:46, 13 minutes later, okay? No, I looked, I watched so many things, read so many things on this. No one says a thing about this, but I Google mapped the location of these places. They are less than 500 feet apart. So why did it take her 13 minutes to drive 500 feet? Where did she go? What did she do?
Yeah, where is that time?
It's so weird. Even that is weird.
Yeah.
It would take you, what, 40 seconds to drive 500 feet? But for 13 minutes, she's unaccounted for. So she either meandered around town or I don't know what.
Yeah.
But she definitely left the McDonald's. It's very strange, guys. I don't know.
Yeah.
The drive home was nearly 3 hours, and they were only half an hour into the trip. It would seem like you'd want to just get home and rest as soon as possible, but already Diane's travel times were not adding up. It was weird. At 10:58, 12 minutes after pulling into the Sunoco, Diane pulled back out and headed south on Route 17 towards Long Island. 39 minutes later, at 11:37, Emma Hance, that was one of the kids in the van, called her father, Warren, to let him know that they would be late getting back. She then handed the phone to Diane, who said traffic was heavy and was making them late. Now, by the way, I looked it up and reports show that traffic was normal to light that day. So again, weird. I don't know.
Yeah.
Warren would later say that when he spoke to Diane, she sounded completely normal. However, it seems that directly after the phone call, for whatever reason, this is where Diane lost control. It's so strange. From about 11:40 to noon, many fellow motorists reported seeing a red minivan driving aggressively, splitting lanes, passing on the shoulder, riding people's bumpers, and honking at them. Two of these witnesses, Gerald Salerno and Francis Bagley, reported that several cars had to swerve out of the way to avoid being struck by Diane. They also said that she had a blank yet determined glare in her eyes with both hands white-knuckling the wheel. So that's what's weird is, literally minutes after having like a coherent, calm conversation with Warren, yeah, traffic's a little bit thicker than what we anticipated, so we're going to be a little bit late. Minutes after that, she is driving like a goddamn maniac.
Yeah.
Something snap. I don't know. Did something snap or what happened?
Yeah.
But this is just the start. Jackie Hance, Warren's wife and mother to Allison, Emma, and Kate, she called Diane at 12:08. Emma had an upcoming play at school, and Jackie asked Diane how many tickets she wanted for the show. Now, here's where it gets weird again, because according to Jackie, Diane sounded totally composed and normal. But preceding this call, she'd been driving like a maniac, right? And right after the call, there were more reports of Diane driving aggressively and honking her horn at people. So it's like when the phone rang, what did she do? Did she shut it down and keep it composed long enough to talk to the brother and the sister-in-law? And then as soon as she was off the phone, she went batshit again? I don't know.
Very bizarre.
Golly.
Yeah, I don't know what to say.
Somewhere around this time, a couple of motorists reported seeing Diane pull off the road at a rest stop and get out of the van. She then leaned over and appeared to vomit, although she was blocked by the open door of the van, so she could have been doing something else. We'll never know. There's a lot of theories about what she was doing. We'll get to that later.
Okay.
At about 12:55, a wrong number was dialed from Diane's phone. 3 minutes later, the family finally got their first indication that something was not right. Diane called Jackie back and sounded extremely disoriented. Jackie tried to figure out what Diane was trying to say, but after 2.5 minutes, the call ended. So now, even on the phone, Diane sounds wacko or whatever. She's not making any sense. And now the family finally is like, oh, what the hell's going on?
Hmm.
Jackie immediately told Warren that something was wrong with Diane, and he called Diane at 1 o'clock or right after. They spoke for 8 minutes, and although Warren has never fully revealed what she said, he did say that she mistakenly called him Danny, which is her husband's name, Daniel, you know, not Warren.
I mean, that's not uncommon, though.
Okay. Could have been a mistake. Easy mistake. And he also said, though, that when he talked to her, she was very sluggish and disoriented. So again, now this is two people that have talked to her and they're like, oh, okay, something's wrong. She does not sound right. So he tells Diane, pull over and wait, and I'm going to come get you.
Yeah.
So she pulls over on the Tappan Zee Bridge at approximately 1:02 p.m. But directly after this, a very distraught Emma called her parents and told them there's something wrong with Aunt Diane. So now the kids are freaking out. Warren asked where they were, and Emma said they were on a bridge by a toll. And Warren's like, look around. Do you see any marks, any landmarks, any signs? And she saw a sign that said Tarrytown and Sleepy Hollow, like exits to those towns. So Warren hung up and immediately raced from his home on Long Island to the Tappan Zee Bridge. He knows where they're at now, okay? Just a few minutes later, several, I think 4 or 5 wrong numbers are dialed from Diane's phone. Then at 1:15, Warren tries to call Diane, but her phone goes straight to voicemail. Well, they did not yet know it, but Diane had gotten out of the van and placed her phone on a guardrail by the toll booth, got back in the van, and drove away. So she leaves her phone on the side of the road after that. From there, for reasons unknown, Diane abandoned the route home. And just after crossing the Tappan Zee Bridge, she exited the highway and began to drive aimlessly through Elmsford. Meanwhile, a now panicked Warren placed a dozen more calls to Diane's phone, but of course, they went all to voicemail. Her phone's just sitting on the side of the road, you know, all on its lonesome. Sam's looking at the maps now. Diane continued to drive erratically, honk her horn, flash her lights, tailgate people, and quickly switch from lane to lane, sometimes splitting lanes. Several calls were placed to 911 reporting her behavior. Then, just after 1:30 p.m., Diane drove up the exit ramp onto the wrong side of the Taconic State Parkway, traveling south in the northbound lane into oncoming traffic at 80 miles per hour.
Oh. Crap.
Yeah, I'm telling you, man. It's so bizarre, isn't it? Like, within a matter of hours, she just goes from totally chill and leaving the campsite and even having, you know, conversations where she sounded totally normal with family members to she just loses her shit completely. So now she's driving 80 miles an hour in the wrong lane on the Taconic Parkway. So obviously, 911 calls are pouring in. Like, everyone is reporting this crazy-ass woman barreling head-on into oncoming traffic. Jackie Hance also called the police and reported that her sister-in-law had her children and was acting erratically. Police began to attempt to track Diane's phone to get her location, but of course, unbeknownst to them, she didn't have her phone anymore. Warren Hance was still on his way to the Tappan Zee Bridge, and now Daniel and his brother Jimmy had also headed upstate to try to find Diane. So now everyone, you know, in the immediate family knows something's up with Diane. Everybody get up there. Half of them falsely believe that she has pulled over on the bridge, you know, so they're just going to try to get to her and help her. At this point, that's all they knew. So also at this point, Diane's family is thinking that she is having some sort of medical emergency, right? And needs assistance. That's what they thought.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, based on what they had, that would be the best guess.
Like, is she having a stroke or, you know, I don't know what you would think at that point. So meanwhile, Diane was still driving fast and aggressively. Again, it was reported by fellow motorists that she had a blank, determined look on her face and white-knuckling the wheel. This continued for just a few minutes while people in oncoming lanes had to swerve out of her way including Peter and Elaine Royal, who had to swerve off the road and into the grass to avoid being struck by Diane. And again, on this documentary, several of these people are interviewed. They said she never even flinched or acknowledged them in any way as she barreled head-on towards them. Peter Grotto was also someone that had to swerve off the highway to avoid being struck by Diane, as well as another motorist named Emily Friedberg. A couple named Lorna and Richard Morell were also traveling on the Taconic that day and barely avoided a head-on crash with Diane. It's important to note here that every one of these witnesses reported that Diane had that 1,000-yard stare on her face and never attempted to move or swerve the van out of the way. She kept her foot on the floor and the van straight ahead. Didn't move for anything. Yeah. Some of the witnesses said it looked as though she was playing chicken. Then after traveling 1.7 miles in the wrong direction on the Taconic, Diane's minivan struck a 2004 Chevy Blazer, Trailblazer, that is, head-on. The three occupants of that car, 81-year-old Michael Bastardi, his 49-year-old son, Guy Bastardi, and 74-year-old Daniel Longo, were killed instantly. After striking the Trailblazer, the minivan rolled and settled in the grassy median between the two lanes. As it came to rest, it burst into flames. Several people who had witnessed the crash pulled over to help. Edward Blakey and Kevin Martz were the first to get to the burning minivan. And again, this is just disclaimer, man. This is just one of those. I'm just going to have to read through this, okay? And do it quick. We all have kids and this just sucks. But they saw the girls piled inside the van and attempted to open the sliding door, but it would not budge. They then moved around to the passenger door and forced it open. As they did, Diane's limp body rolled out of the car to the ground at their feet. They then proceeded to help remove the girls from the burning van while others showed up to help. Of the seven people in the van, only two were alive. One of the nieces was in critical condition, and 5-year-old Brian was severely injured but alive. The niece would pass away in the hospital later that day. So of the 9 people involved in the head-on crash, Brian, little Brian, is the only survivor. A third vehicle, a Geo Tracker, was also hit by the Trailblazer as it ricocheted off the minivan, but its occupants were unharmed. So that's the chaos that resulted in this.
Wow.
And I mean, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah, sure.
So this is where it gets even wilder. Because everyone's wondering, right, what the hell could have caused this supermom, like rock-solid, level-headed lady, to essentially just snap.
Yeah.
And kill all these people. As police and first responders processed the scene, they found the first clue as to what may have caused Diane to behave so strangely that day. Next to where she had been sitting in the van was a bottle of Absolut vodka. Meanwhile, in the following days, the completely devastated Hance and Schuler families buried their loved ones. Warren publicly spoke of his sister as a saint, a perfect mom, and a fantastic person. Daniel also described Diane as the perfect wife and mother. And you'll see all this. This is just, I guess, maybe a long commercial for that documentary. I don't know, but all their interviews and stuff is on there. So soon after, a toxicology report was done. And this is where it gets even crazier, all right? Diane had a blood alcohol level of 0.19%, which is over twice the legal limit. Based on her weight, according to the experts that I looked at, she likely had at least 10 alcoholic drinks in the hour before she died. And there was still 6 grams of undigested alcohol in her stomach, okay? She was a Faust.
Wow.
She also had a very high level of THC in her system, meaning she'd either smoked or eaten marijuana as recently as 15 to 20 minutes before the crash. So she's got a minivan full of kids and she's smoking weed or eating gummies and slamming, you know, I mentioned that orange juice earlier. That's a theory is that she was making.
It was in there.
Yeah. Because you always mix vodka and orange juice or, you know, that's a common thing to do. Being the sole survivor of the crash, little Brian was asked if he remembered anything about his mother's state of mind during that trip.
I was
wondering about that too. Yeah, I mean, and he's only five. The only thing he's ever said is, "Mommy said her head hurt and she could not see." That was it.
Hmm.
But I'm thinking, if your head hurts and you can't see, you pull over.
Yeah.
Right? You don't slam the gas to the floor and scream and honk at people and switch lanes and drive like a maniac.
But if she was under the influence, then
yeah,
that explains that.
Yeah.
I mean, but not to that level, though. Not to that level to where, I don't know, just, I mean, you hear about traffic fatalities because of substances, but not anything like this, really, where it's like road rage.
Yes. So
I feel
aggressive.
Like there has to be more that goes into it, right. Which those are definitely factors.
Mm-hmm. But she hadn't been, like, when everybody left that morning, she hadn't been drinking.
Not according to Daniel.
They didn't notice anything.
And the people in McDonald's and the people in the Sunoco gas station, they also said, now, I don't know if someone just briefly walking in and out, how much can you tell? But they said, as far as they're concerned, she seemed totally sober. But she'd been driving around, like, this trip, it took so much longer than it should have. So she had plenty of time to get properly soused, you know.
Yeah, man, that's, and to know that you're going to haul all those people home.
Yeah.
And to do that.
It's crazy.
To do any substance.
It really, from what I could tell, does not match anything about her personality or the kind of person she was. That's what makes it, one of the things that makes it so.
Sure, bizarre. Yeah. Wow.
Daniel Shuler and sister-in-law Jay Shuler vehemently denied that Diane could have been drunk or high at the time of the crash or any other time.
Well, one thing, if she made it to Elmsford, she was an hour from home.
Okay. So she made it 2/3 of the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she made it. She took forever to do so, but she was close.
What was the name of that bridge?
Tappan, T-A-P-P-A-N, and then Z-E-E, the Tappan okay. Z Bridge.
So it's probably this bridge.
That's
right
the
here,
bridge, yeah. Right now right it's called up. Like the Governor Cuomo Bridge or something. I think they may have changed it.
So it would have took her brother an hour to get there.
Okay.
If she would have just waited.
Which is way too. But yeah. I mean, she didn't wait at all, you know? She just placed her phone on that median or whatever it was and left, took off. But yeah, what is a really incredibly frustrating thing is the denial of her husband, Daniel, and then the sister-in-law, Jay, that she could have been high. Despite the toxicology reports, they're like, no, those are wrong. She never drank, did not smoke weed. It's impossible, right? They spoke to any news crew that would listen. And Daniel swore to each one that his wife did not drink and never smoked marijuana. They even took to national news outlets like CNN, back when it was taken seriously, and even went on Larry King, professing Diane's character and sobriety. Anyone who would listen. Daniel and Jay also expressed doubt that the toxicology tests that showed her 0.19% blood alcohol content were valid. When the tests were run again, they then suggested that maybe the lab had accidentally tested the wrong blood sample because the tests came up the same, right? So now they're like, we think that maybe you got the wrong blood sample. Maybe it wasn't Diane's blood.
Hmm.
So they did a DNA test on that blood from which the toxicology reports had been made, and it was Diane Shuler's. The test confirmed that. But the more that the evidence proved Diane was drunk and high at the time of the crash, the more Daniel and Jay clamored for excuses as to why. They were still insistent that a medical event had occurred first, which caused a confused and disoriented Diane to mistakenly drink the vodka and smoke the pot.
I've never heard of that
yeah.
scenario or that syndrome.
They swear, yeah, it's, man, on the documentary, it shows Daniel, he's saying like, you know, I think a medical thing happened where maybe, you know, like there's the vodka and she thought it was water and she was thirsty and accidentally drank it all. And it's like, God, you guys are reaching so far.
Thanks for putting a voice to that face for me.
That's exactly what, it's the Long Island, yeah. You know, it's the Yankee yeah. thing, yeah. And I feel, look, the guy lost his wife and daughter.
Yeah.
But despite that, by the end of the documentary, you want to punch this guy in the face.
Really?
Just over his absolute denial. And I get it. No one wants to believe that their wife, you know, went ape shit and drank a bunch of vodka and smoked weed and killed a bunch of people. No one would want to.
But you said the sister-in-law was also
just as much.
But what about the brother?
You know, you don't hear a lot. at least in the documentary and from the research, like the Hanses, like Warren and Jackie, kind of like at the very beginning, they were, you know, professing Diane's character and saying she was a great mom. But when those toxicology reports came out, they clamored up. Warren and Jackie, as far as I know, and eventually the Shulers, like Daniel, and the Hanses have a total falling out.
Yeah.
And there's like lawsuits back and forth and everything. Right. It gets ugly later.
Wow.
But yeah, the denial is off the charts. You know, they just will not come to terms. And like I said, you have to look at it from both sides. Like if my wife was involved in some sort of incident like this, and that was what came back, those toxicology reports, I wouldn't want to believe that either.
Sure.
Like, well, yeah. You're telling me my wife was, you know, totally irresponsible and killed a bunch of people. You know, I'd probably try to come up with excuses, but my God, at some point you have to face facts, you would think.
Yeah.
I don't know. So yeah, Daniel and Jay, we're going to be talking about them a lot from here on out. They were insistent that a medical event occurred first, which, you know, Diane thought the vodka was water. I don't know. And accidentally smoked the pot. I don't know, guys. I'm not saying it makes sense. They even suggested that she may have thought the vodka was water. I think I just said that. However, the fact that Diane may have bought a large orange juice at McDonald's that morning definitely goes hand in hand with a bottle of vodka, just like I said. After receiving some of Diane's past medical records, they fixated on a bad tooth she had visited the dentist for 4 years earlier. Okay? Let's buckle up for this ride. The mental gymnastics.
Okay.
Diane had had a root canal like 4 years prior, but supposedly needed more work done. She visited the dentist a couple more times after that, but hadn't been back since about a year before the incident, okay? Not long before the incident, Daniel reported that Diane would sometimes rub her cheek. He guessed that her tooth was hurting. So the family zeroed in on this tooth pain theory, suggesting that maybe the pain was so bad, she accidentally ingested all the weed and alcohol.
This theory brought to you by the American Dental Association, reminding you to take care of your teeth and gums. That's what I think about this theory. It seems so weird. It just seems like it's made up.
Yeah, it's reaching, man. And I don't know how it was going to exonerate her from any wrongdoing.
There's way better painkillers than those two things when you have real pain like that.
Do you have a toothache? Are you experiencing gum pain? Do you have a minivan full of children that you're transporting on a freeway? May we suggest a shitload of vodka and marijuana?
But wait a second. This seems like an avenue to take to accept the toxicology and accept that it just seems like a, like, oh, okay, well, we'll take that because it's probably the tooth thing.
Yeah.
Like a ridiculous thing.
As if that excuses.
There was an episode of Dr. House where this man, he had, you know, remember sometimes he had to go down and do clinic duty and he hated it. Yeah, I love that show. I don't know if you guys ever watched.
Yeah, I've seen several.
But he just had to take care of regular coughs and flu and stuff like that.
And be a dick to everybody.
Exactly. And he was, because he hated it. So there's this couple, they were in there and they had a weird STD. And he said, well, one of you had to be unfaithful. And the guy was like, I wasn't. And the girl was like, oh, I definitely wasn't. And so he's like, well, wait a second. There is one more thing it could be. If you're not careful in a public bathroom and you don't always wipe the seat down, you can get it from that. And the man is instantly like, oh yeah, that was me. I never do that. And he said, and you're the one that's unfaithful because it would be ridiculous for you to think that was a viable way to get that STD.
But he took the out.
Yeah, he took the out. So this very similarly seems like that, like they just took the out, a way to like accept that, you know?
Yeah.
No,
it makes perfect sense. This documentary shows Jay and Daniel going through Diane's medical records. Oh, this tooth right here. I bet you the tooth was, they're desperate. And you hate them because they won't accept it, but also you have a little bit of apathy because who would want to accept that?
Sure.
Of course they don't want to accept it.
Yeah. Not that I have any of the answers, but that's just my idea.
Yeah.
In the podcast chair.
Well, yeah. So like my thing is, okay, what they're saying is, okay, Diane had this horrible toothache. Well, okay, this is coming from a guy, I've had a fear of the dentist my whole life. When I was 12, I remember my parents drug me in for a regular cleaning, okay? I didn't go back to the dentist for like another 30 years.
It was that good, huh?
I'm not joking. I had like 4 teeth on the back, 4 bottom molars here, 3 over here that got cavities. Guys, I let them go until the back teeth were gone. They were just not there. It was so bad, okay? But it was rarely painful.
Mm-hmm.
And when it did start to get painful, this is no joke. I'm this much of a redneck. I'm sorry, guys. I would go to the co-op and I would buy fish biotics, antibiotics.
Yeah. Fish mox.
Yeah, fish mox, moxicillin. I would take those and I would take painkillers and it would go away for a few months. Then it would come back. I would do painkillers and moxicillin or whatever. And it would go away until finally I had like 3 toothaches in a week. You know, my wife was finally like, you're going to have to get this freaking taken care of, you maniac. So I went and had 7 of these things pulled. I said all that to say, I have a lot of experience with toothaches. I've had the worst pain I've ever had in my life was a toothache. And oddly enough, the only thing that would help it, I got a glass of ice cold water and I would take a mouthful of the water and hold it over on that tooth and the pain would subside.
Just like numb it from the,
yes. Yeah. And then until the water kind of warmed up and then I'd have to spit it out and do it again. I did that all night one night. I didn't get any sleep.
Wow.
It was horrible.
I bet.
I'm saying all that to say, you know what I didn't do? I didn't drink a bunch of f***ing vodka and eat a bunch of marijuana and drive 80 miles an hour in the wrong lane of a highway like a maniac. But yeah, let's forget even why she was drunk. What caused her to lose her mind, drive like a maniac? And think about this too. The last at least 20, 30 minutes, you got 5 kids screaming and crying and freaking out too. Like, how did that not snap her out of whatever?
Yeah.
She was in.
Yeah, for sure.
So during the weeks following the crash, Daniel slowly began to admit that Diane did drink occasionally. Though he first denied knowing why the vodka was at the campsite, he eventually admitted that they always kept vodka at the campsite. He said, and I quote, you know, just to sit around the campfire with s'mores and drink vodka. I've never had vodka with my s'mores, but...
No, it ruined the taste of the s'mores.
I figured it'd say a little fire starter.
Yeah, could do that too. But no, in the documentary, he's like, you know, we just, you sit around and you make s'mores and you drink your vodka, you know? And I think most people are like, I don't know, actually, what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah.
But that's what he said. And so he finally did admit that Diane smoked pot on rare occasions. Another family member said, Diane smoked it all the time, especially before bed because it helped her sleep. So like the truth is finally coming out, right?
Huh. Yeah.
Let's be clear that we're not judging Diane for smoking. We're just using this as another example of how Daniel is either not truthful or there was a lot he didn't know about his wife. It's one or the other. This guy either knows a lot more about her and he doesn't want to divulge it because it would make her look worse.
And him. Because if he knew that she would have the propensity to do that, of course, I know the guy lost his own kid. So I don't know. Being very careful here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rough. It's just rough. That's my fallback if I don't want to keep talking.
Dude.
It was a rough one.
Although Warren and Jackie Hance were advocates of Diane at first, I kind of alluded to this earlier, it seems that relations between them and the Shulers deteriorated after the toxicology results were released. And from what I read, communications between the families stopped. What replaced those communications was lawsuits. I read several accounts that Daniel sued the Hance family for the cost of the crashed minivan. He also sued the New York State Highway Department because the highway said was unsafe. Yeah, that doesn't make sense because it was their minivan.
Yeah,
maybe that was a typo.
It's not safe if you're going the wrong way. It can never be safe.
But why is he suing his in-laws for...
It was their minivan.
And for her driving.
Yeah, I don't know.
But how could you expect to win that one ever? Well, never mind. We have our court system.
Well, that's true.
But how could you ever expect to win that because of all the... Well, it's eyewitness, but still. I mean, just all the craziness on how she was driving.
I know.
And going the wrong way. That one's kind of hard to refute.
And I didn't this didn't occur to me. Why would he sue them for the cost of their van? She was in their van. I don't know. That may require some more looking up, guys. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense at all. Does
yeah,
it?
No.
Yeah. So that may have either been like whatever source I used was wrong, but
that's,
or
at least that's the first thing in this whole episode that doesn't make sense.
maybe it sue them for the van wasn't safe. I don't know. Maybe
it I don't know. Okay. We'll just breeze past that.
Yeah.
But yeah, he did sue the highway department because he said the highway was unsafe. Like Ivan said, you know, you have to drive the right way.
Yeah.
With traffic.
Or else without vodka.
Yeah. Without the vodka. The following is from an article in Courthouse News Service that came out in 2011. Quote, the husband of a woman who killed herself and seven other people, including four children driving drunk and stoned the wrong way on the Taconic State Parkway, has sued the estate of the man his wife crashed into and killed. He sued the estate of the Bastardis.
Why?
Holy shit.
Why?
Daniel Schuler also, let's see here. Daniel Schuler also sued his brother-in-law, whose car Schuler's late wife was driving and who lost his three daughters in the crash. So I was right about that. He did sue the brother-in-law. I don't know if it was for the cost of the car. That wouldn't make sense. Now Schuler's husband, Daniel, on behalf of his dead daughter and the son who survived the crash, has sued the office of the Suffolk County Public Administrator as court-appointed administrator of his late wife's estate. He's suing everybody. Daniel is. He also sued Hans and Roseanne Guzzo, who was executor for the Bastardis. The complaint in Suffolk County Court claims that Diane Schuler and Bastardi were both driving recklessly on July 26th.
Yeah, he was driving the right way. He was recklessly driving in the correct lane.
Dudes, it is off
the charts.
You have
to yield to her. I don't know. What are we even?
It is off the charts bananas. That's like if you assault someone and then sue them because their face ran into your fist. It's that stupid. It doesn't make sense. Daniel says both drivers were, quote, inappropriate physical condition and state of mind. They were in an inappropriate physical
condition. How does he know that about the other guy that's dead?
That's a good question, sir. He also said that the Bastardis were driving at a dangerous, unlawful, and excessive rate of speed.
And how does he know that?
Here's what I don't get, and I've been thinking about this for some other cases. There can be lawyers that just like turn down cases to the point where you just can't find a lawyer. I mean, I just wish they would get on the same page and everyone that was slid that. Here's what I'm thinking about doing. Why can't there be a consensus like, this is stupid? No.
Yeah.
If you ask anybody else, this is stupid.
Right.
No. The same way, I don't know, maybe you just can't have that consensus with humans, but because there's always someone want to make a buck. That's the real problem.
Yep.
But
will you pay me? Okay, let's sue them.
I don't know. I was going to go further with that, but that's all I have to say about that.
No, really, I can think of nothing crazier. Like she literally was drunk and driving the wrong way and killed a bunch of people, and he's suing the family of the people she killed? That defies all logic. It's crazy.
Yeah. OJ versus Nicole Brown Simpson. You know, he's suing her for dying.
Right. He's still looking for the killer, though.
Oh, yeah.
Bless his heart.
We'll find him.
So Daniel also claims in this that each car was in a state of disrepair. He seeks damages for funeral expenses and medical bills. But you'll be shocked to know that the charges were never filed, you know, due to any of these complaints.
Well, yeah.
Prosecutors, go ahead.
No, I just was thinking I might have found somebody I don't like as much as Kim McElroy and his lawyer.
When you watch the documentary, just read through the comments. It is just everyone lighting up Daniel and Jay Schuler just for their astonishing denial. It's astonishing. It's the worst case of denial.
I think it's just because he knew in everything is deflection.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So prosecutors said at the time that the charges died with Schuler, right? Nothing was going to happen. Months after the crash, the Bastardi's estate sued Schuler's estate and the Hanses, which is It was their van, but goddamn, they weren't there. Their kids died in it.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Some lawyer talked somebody into it.
Talk about salt in the wound.
God, right?
Yeah.
Like, not only did your three kids die, now I'm going to sue you.
Yeah.
Because my wife crashed your van.
It's insanity.
I'm going to blame legal team. I mean, it's some legal team where some guy said they should do that.
Some guy was like, isn't it possible?
Yeah. When was this? Was Gene McFadden still alive?
Yeah.
No, I think he died.
This was his last case.
Enjoy your money. How do you sleep?
Yep.
You know.
Yeah. So, ABC News reported that Hans's wife, Jackie, sued Diane Schuler the day after Schuler filed his lawsuit against them. Like, everyone's just suing everybody, right?
Wait, so she sued...
I guess she countersued...
But yeah, she's suing the dead person.
Right, I guess the estate of Diane, I guess is what it would be. After the accident, Daniel Schuler defended his wife's innocence and disputed the results of the toxicology report, claiming his wife did not abuse drugs and alcohol. Dude, they were in her system. Like, how do you reconcile that? How? The mental gymnastics must be insane. It's there. It was in her system, you know?
It's a cop-out. Couldn't be so, or else he would have some part.
Right. So Warren and Jackie, who I feel so bad for, man.
Yeah.
They started the Hance Family Foundation to honor the lives of Emma, Allison, and Katie. It provides various types of self-esteem programs worldwide. By the way, a few years after that, they had another daughter.
Mm.
They had a kid again. Brian Schuler, little five-year-old Brian, who was in the wreck, eventually made a full recovery but sustained permanent brain and eye damage, although he has since rehabilitated to a point where he is able to lead a pretty normal life. It was crazy because... the only reason I think that Brian lived was because, just to put it bluntly, he was cushioned by the bodies of all the girls. He was under all of them. So they didn't even, you know, initially the rescuers didn't even know that a little boy was in there until they moved. And I'm telling you, if anyone listening watches There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, if you don't shed a tear at the end of it, I've watched it four or five times over the years. I still cry at the end of it. Because it's one of the rescuers talking about pulling out the little girl and just trying to resuscitate her. And it will rip your heart out of your chest. Oh my God, it's rough. But yeah, they didn't see the boy at first, but that's pretty much why Brian survived. But that's the end of the notes. And so I kind of know, Ivan, I kind of know your theory.
Yeah. I think that it was always worse. Her problems with addiction. They did a great job of downplaying and hiding it. But on this day, they couldn't. And whatever happened, she freaked out that day. And then obviously, it's also a testament to the fact that she could turn it off and back on again with the phone calls. So that, that's where I am. Just goes to show you generational trauma. I mean, obviously, she had it because we started off saying she didn't want to acknowledge her mom.
Right.
So, wow. Which is, trauma is the gateway to everything.
It really is, man. And like, was the pressures, so I feel, and it's not, I didn't create this theory. A lot of people, I've read about this. A lot of people feel like it was the trauma of her mother just leaving her at 9 that caused her to maybe overcompensate whenever she started a family and overdo everything and feel like she had to be, you know, super mom. And the overwhelming pressures of that while holding down this full-time job. Daniel was no help at all. He just seems like a big goof, you know, that kind of was just, doop-de-doo, he's just there.
It's Homer Simpson.
Yeah, he's a Homer. She's just taking care of him, too. He just happens to be the tallest kid, right?
Yeah.
And so was the pressures of all that so much that she turned to alcohol, you know, to medicate her. I don't know.
Sam, what do you got?
Not much else to say than what's already been said. But it's got to be more than just an alcohol thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I think.
So
yeah.
That one of the theories is, let's
I'm
do
not,
this.
I'm not putting it all just on like, oh, well, yeah, she was drinking and.
No.
No, that's.
No, because yeah. No matter how much you drink, it doesn't make you flip and want to kill
right,
your family.
Exactly.
Right. So there was something else there. That's the thing.
Yeah.
There's a large camp that believes that this was a suicide. You know, that.
Man, why do it with four kids in a car?
Exactly.
The equivalent of
five kids.
The mom that drowned the kids and the, you know, that type of thing.
Darlie Rudier killed her kids, like, but she didn't kill herself. But yeah, I don't know.
That's the part that doesn't make sense the most.
Yeah,
of me to everything is like, okay, if you do, why, especially with kids that aren't your own? That's just horrible.
It's just like the high rates of speed, though. I'm just thinking of a drunk driver in my brain. What I've seen in my life, which is a very small sample size. Once in a while you see that car at like 2 a.m. You're like, oh, stay away from them.
Yeah.
But to me, they're like slower, lethargic.
Yeah.
It's not like white knuckle driving.
Right. Right.
So maybe something snapped, you know?
But did something snap and it caused her to drink all the alcohol, or did she start drinking alcohol and something snapped? It's such a bizarre thing.
Seems way more probable of not all of a sudden I'm just going to drink a whole bunch.
Right.
Because I think you would, I mean, the vomiting thing plays well for that, but
right.
It seems like if you drink that much that fast, you just pass out.
Yeah.
There's no indication that she passed out. It was that she was like sitting straight up, like.
Very, with full intent. You know, that's the same thing everybody said, was she was like straight ahead, over the wheel, eyes wide, white knuckle, not moving, you know, not even moving at all at that, once she was going the wrong way. So, and a lot of people think that she intended to commit suicide and crash the van, and she had drank all the alcohol as kind of a courage.
She wouldn't feel it.
Liquid courage wouldn't feel it. Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I've researched this for a long time. I don't have a theory. I don't know at all.
I know something. Maybe after a tragedy, you shouldn't have 1,000 lawyers make a bunch of money.
That's what we learned from all this.
Blood suckers, man.
Yeah.
I'm kind of done with all of them.
Yeah.
I get it. They defend people in bad situations, but more often than not with these cases, you just hear this ridiculous, like they come out with ridiculous things that aren't even grounded in reality. Like this motion because another, it's like, there's more nonsense than rational behavior.
Yeah.
Because all they want to do is just make a bunch of money.
Yep. Yep.
So anyway, that's all I'll say about that.
I would say that she had, let's think about this. What if she had been building up this pressure and resentment and anxiety about all the perfect, you know, mom things that she had to portray and do all this? What if that had been boiling in there for so long and just this day, it happened to boil over, you know? And maybe, let's think about this. Maybe the kids were all being crazy and kind of sparked it off, and she was yelling at them. You know, five kids in there ranging from like 2 to 9. What if they're all bouncing around and she's just getting frustrated, and then it just boils it over where...
So she's the bus driver from Happy Gilmore? Or, yeah, I'm sorry, Farley. Billy Madison?
Yeah, Chris Farley.
I'm sorry. I got to do...
I know you got to
people at home. It's a defense mechanism. I got to bring humor into it. I'm hurting here.
But what if that's what caused her to just say, you know what, screw it, and then she is drinking.
I was thinking something like that earlier a little bit. Yeah,
yeah, there's just that, like being the straw that broke the camel's back, basically.
But I don't know, man. The kids are the ones calling the.
Yeah,
parents.
I would imagine they got pretty quiet pretty fast.
Yeah. But
by that point, was it already over? You know.
Right.
Another thing I was thinking is that the Charles, I can't think of his last name, the tower shooter.
Oh, yeah.
I was hoping they checked really well for postmortem tumors and things like that. Because remember, his was a glioblastoma that more than likely, I think they're on the fence about that. But that's not a sudden thing, though.
Whitman.
Yeah, Charles Whitman.
Yeah, yeah. So they did an autopsy on her. By the way, they didn't find an abscessed tooth or any of the bullshit that the family, you know. I think a tooth was hurting, so she accidentally, whatever. Didn't find that. But
so
they
crazy,
didn't reveal anything else. You know, they didn't say they found any tumors or whatever. I don't know. If
I mean, I don't feel like that's not a sudden thing. That's a growth that, you know.
Yeah.
But even the Charles Whitman guy was pretty rational right before he did that. He wrote some letters and stuff, and from what I remember.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to put it together because I've had terrible toothaches. I've been really drunk. I've never had the both together, but I can't see how even having both together would cause me to just become a homicidal maniac, you know, and kill a bunch of people, including my own family. It just doesn't make sense.
Seems like you just watched the new season of Rick and Morty or something. But I don't know.
So yeah, to this day, as far as I know, the family still swears that it was a medical thing that caused her to somehow mistakenly drink a whole bottle of vodka and smoke a bunch of weed. And then it doesn't make sense because they said she just was not aware of what she was doing, was driving the wrong way. But man, when you're honking and swerving, and the people that saw it said it wasn't like a meandering swerve. It was like she would go from one lane to the other, like fast. Like see, it was intense. This
doesn't seem, yeah.
It was very precise. Boom, 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 like that.
Man, I don't know. We'll never know.
No.
This is a recent case, but we'll never know. Relatively recent.
Yeah. Yeah.
2009, I agree, was that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's Diane Schuler, the Taconic Parkway killer. That's.
Wow. Yeah.
4174 Mantis, if you have any theories or ideas whatsoever. Sure. Yeah.
You can call it, leave a message, or you can text it. We won't answer. It just goes straight to voicemail.
Yeah. So, anything to add, boys?
No, that's a terrible one, but also a good case, Joe.
Yeah.
Good job on that one.
We're wanting to cover that one. And next week, I won't say, but I'll just give a little teaser. We're covering another one that I've had on my bucket list for a long time.
Okay. So it's January bucket list for,
yeah.
For Joe.
Yeah, there you
Joe's
go.
Joe's January bucket list.
There we go. We need a promo for it.
Yeah.
We got one of those little horn things.
Yeah, right. So that's it. Thank you all for listening. Again, we appreciate it. And we will catch you on the next one.
Let me tell you about some fellas I know named Ivan, Sam, and Joe. They got themselves a little podcast, you know. And they talk about everything under the sun that they find interesting, spooky, or fun. And they sure ain't trying to impress no one. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the dawn of Mantis. They talk about killers, monsters, and cults, French mates from hell, disappeared folks. Occasionally throw in a few dad jokes. They try to make every story extra nice by adding their own ginger spice. Not one time or two, but thrice. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the dawn of Mantis. Now I'm sure these fellas will be around for quite a spell, 'cause there sure ain't no shortage of stories to tell. This old world's as weird as hell. But hell, even if nobody listened, you know they'd maintain a fine disposition, 'cause shooting the breeze is kind of their mission. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the dawn of Mantis. Too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the dawn.